90% of all scientists that have ever been alive are alive today. That's a lot of information. But don't panic. It's not an exact science.
Hey, Shannon, how are you?
Doing pretty well. It's oral exam week, so you know how that goes.
I do. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
everybody thinks that they're the worst as a student, and they don't realize that really they're even worse as the professor.
Exactly. I know that's what I tell them, but they don't listen. I say, I have to do, you know, I only have to do 14 of them this year, so that's really not bad. The year I did 42 was rough.
I mean, other than it was 42, which is awesome.
Yes, correct. Yeah. It's really great. I was talking to a colleague in political science, and they were discussing how they like to do things to throw students off guard, right? So I think I'm notorious for, if you don't show up for class, I'm definitely having a quiz. And it's going to be like an easy quiz, you know, but you're definitely getting a grade today if there aren't many people there. And so she does that sort of thing. But then she analyzes the data because her quizzes are like, name four people in the class. And all this stuff. And then she'll go through and analyze the data and say, this is the most popular people. Everyone knows who you are. And she said something that was amazing, which she had a class of 30, I think, 28, something like that. And she said that inevitably, the name that people remember the most, like that student, is always one of the quieter students in the class.
Huh.
Isn't that interesting?
It's whose paper everybody looks.
Yeah, there's a lot of really interesting psychological things about that. But it's been, you know, the weeks of the oral exams are pretty intense, obviously. But I've also done something else that I'm very intrigued to see how it works. We got to wait a week and a half to see if it works.
Are you growing something?
No. Well, intelligence, hopefully. So a long time ago, we had a fun paper called Night Science. Do you remember this fun paper?
I do vaguely, about how, like, after-hours side projects often turn into the big things, right?
It kind of focused on the fact that in science we're told not to do things like anthropomorphize stuff.
Okay, yeah.
Right? So they came from biology backgrounds, and so they're not supposed to say, the cell wants this. And so therefore, yeah, the mitochondria want to do this, or, you know, they don't want anything. It's how it, just how it works, right? And so they came up with this whole idea of night science. And the night science is the time where, like, you're allowed to think like that. So you're allowed to be more creative because those times often lead to more insights, even though they're not quote unquote scientific, right? So they have a podcast, and I love it. It's really cool. So the authors of that paper have a podcast called Night Science, and they interview all these, like, very creative people in the sciences. And they were interviewing this guy that runs some famous biology lab, right? So it's all biology stuff. And he has, I thought this was so cool, he has an artist in residence at their laboratory. Right.
Interesting.
Right. Yeah. That dead silence. That's what I was like, why? And he said, I always fund an artist in residence, and they're given a swipe card, and they can go in anywhere. They can talk to anyone about anything. And then they do whatever their particular flavor of art is based on our work. And so not only is it of interest to the artist, but then the scientists get to see how someone else is perceiving what they're doing.
Okay.
So it's kind of just an interesting, you know, like, different take, different ways of thinking about things, promoting creativity. And so they said, this was so cool, that it was this guy and one of the night science guys both do this exercise, and they say that they make the students go to the university art museum, and they have to pick out, or, well, they said they have to relate all of them in, like, certain exhibits or something, an art piece to their science.
Okay.
And so I did this in my graduate class right now. So in my paleomagnetism grad class, you know, we went out and did sampling. We did all that fun stuff that you did when you took the class, and all that jazz. But because we don't have enough time, our sampling was pretty late. It was only last weekend. So we don't have enough time to process all the samples. So I did this. This is their project. I made them write a very scientific, basically abstract, for like what they're working on. Or for the undergrads, it was like, what are you interested in science? Like, what is a very specific thing? And then I said, okay, great. Go to our art museum, the Fred Jones Jr. Museum of Art, and find at least two pieces of art that relate to this. And they stared at me. And I said, yeah.
As I would have done.
Exactly. And I said, nope. Go to the art museum. Figure out how geophysics can be reflected in, you know, the art exhibits there. And I cannot.
Okay.
I cannot wait to see what happens.
I am very curious.
Oh, I'm so excited about it. So hopefully we can, hopefully they blow me away and we can talk about it on the show, because, you know, two of them are my students, three of them now. And so they have very specific, you know, one's looking at magnetostratigraphy of rivers, one's looking at magnetic anisotropy and these zebra dolomites. And then one of the undergrads wrote about seismic, which I thought was actually really cool. I thought you could do a lot with, like, waves
and seismic art. Relates to art is that you can see anything you want into it.
That's exactly right. So that's exactly the joke I said out loud, and he just glared at me. But that is exactly what I thought, too. So I am super excited about this little experiment. And, yeah, so we will talk about it in a couple of weeks once they present them.
I am very curious.
Yeah, but it came straight out of a fun paper, right? So you never know. That's what I'm saying. You never know.
Well, we'll see how this week's fun paper relates to that a little bit later.
I can't wait. There's a lot of fun things to talk about today. I'm pretty excited.
There are a lot of fun things to talk about, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I obviously, my week, I'm tasked with doing something, and it just literally floated into my brain that we should talk about foraminiferum.
So there aren't equations around these, so they're not something I'm very familiar with. I remember them from SedPet, and I remember glaring at my TA as they said, no, that's not 10% forams. It's probably more like 20 or 30%. And me saying, show me a count.
Sedimentology is like the best and the worst, because it can be not quantitative at all or only quantitative.
Or hyper quantitative.
Exactly. Like, both of them exist, but there are never people that are both. You are one or the other, really. Yes, I have an effort to make the class a little more quantitative, but this is certainly, looking at these is certainly one thing that is very difficult and very frustrating for students. But we just started carbonates last week, because I get real wrapped up in the sedimentology or the physics of sedimentology. And so we spend a lot of time on clastics and how individual grains move in fluids.
I mean, how interesting is monomineralic carbonate anyway?
That's my point.
If you're going to take an already boring class of rocks, pick the most boring subcategory. That's carbonate.
Oh, man. Oh, bring on the hate mail.
Yeah, you can send that one straight to me.
So I always joke about that, too. I say the same thing, and yet It's kind of a really fun thing to teach, I think, because everybody loves the beach, so that's kind of fun.
Right.
And these things freak me out. I am very obsessed with looking at, you know, what are those weird things in science, right? And things floating in the water column are so weird to me. And my joke is always, like, you're eating these when you go to the beach. Like, how many of these have you eaten? I've probably eaten a ton of forams.
So on a scale of puppies to geoid, where are forams?
They're kind of cute. So they're not closer to puppies by far, but they're only like 64.8% towards geoid.
Oh, there's that hyperquantization.
You're welcome. And mostly because of their names. We'll get to the names too. But I mean, do you have any memory of forams at all?
Yeah, I remember these little weird shaped shell things. Mm-hmm. I remember the word fusilinid.
Yeah, that's the only one we really talk about.
Right.
So these foraminifera are kind of important. And I am not, despite being a paleomagnetist, it has nothing to do with fossils. Everyone always thinks it does, which kind of blows my mind. I don't do anything with fossils, just fossil magnets. And these guys are a very popular fossil to study. And what they are these little shelled, mostly shelled, organisms that are composed of, because obviously we're talking about you seeing them in thin section, right? So they're composed of mostly carbonate. Sometimes they're composed of chitin. Sometimes they're composed of silica, although not very often. Things that either float in the water column or they live on the bottom of the ocean. And they are great for a lot of things. And that's why lots of people work on these. So they're called foraminifera. We call them forams for short. And their shells are really useful to us.
So these must be some sort of biomarker then.
Yeah, it's all the things. So they do all the things. That's kind of why they're really useful to us. I just taught this the other day. So their little shells are called tests, T-E-S-T, right? And there's some really weird ones, but their chemical composition can tell us about seawater. They can tell us about climate. They can tell us so many things. And so that's why they're really used very frequently. And they're, as you pointed out, they're actually fairly easy to identify. Now, percentages is another thing. It's hard to tell the percentage.
If a geophysicist can identify it in thin section,
exactly.
It's pretty obvious.
Exactly. So it is pretty obvious. I put a bunch of links that I'm sure we can link in the show notes to some YouTube videos. That's the thing I love to do in class, is just randomly pull this up and be like, you drank this if you've been in the ocean. And they see these weird little forams floating around. So you could see them pretty well with your naked eye. And you can definitely see them in thin section. And there's these little calcite shells, usually. They're sometimes silica. But those are, I could only find like one group that was made of silica. So that's kind of rare. I did, when I was looking up the different compositions of them, I saw one website that talked about that they have the living ones. I actually, because I didn't realize this, we look at these in really old rocks, right? Like a lot of our rocks are from the Paleozoic that we have in our particular sedimentology collection. But forams are still alive today. Like they're still going. And when you look at these videos of them swimming around in the water column, they have cytoplasm. I found a page that said ectoplasm, which I don't think that's right.
Somebody had some, yeah. They watched Ghostbusters a little too recently.
Too much, exactly. And so they kind of float around, and a lot of them have spines, which we don't see when we're looking at them in thin section. So I didn't actually realize that. I don't know if you knew that. A bunch of them have spines. Yeah, they're really tiny, and they're covered in this cytoplasm, and they capture stuff. Like, they're little meat eaters, just terrifying, in their spines and dissolve them with their little cytoplasm. And they just hang out. They're living their lives. You know, they live like, I don't know, a week or something and die and either get eaten themselves or fall down. And there's a whole bunch of them.
Yeah, and looking at the pictures of them, well, one, it's amazing how many different shapes there are.
Yeah.
And two, how not like a shell or fossil any of them are.
Exactly.
If you told somebody, like, draw a fossil, they're not going to draw anything like this.
Nothing like this. This is the 60, whatever I said, 3.8% creepy, because this stuff is just floating around in water. But you said there's a bunch of shapes. The shapes of them are broken down into what they call either chambered or aperture. And it's kind of exactly what it sounds like, right? So you know that a nautilus, for example, right? Those little curly shells. That's kind of what some of these chambered ones look like, where they have an opening and they create, as they grow, they create different chambers, like a, I don't know if you could say like a coral. They don't really look like anything. They look like themselves, and that's about it. Like a bunch of grapes, right? Or like a weird curled up snail, something like that. And then you have these aperture ones, which have an opening and basically just globs of stuff around that opening. There's no symmetry, or it looks like rhyme or reason to them. At all.
I mean, these are the two varieties of neighbors you can have as well. Like, you've got the neat and orderly ones that, you know, build a shed in their garden and put everything in it. And you've got the ones that just grow a pile out into the yard.
That's exactly it. That's them. And so a lot of their shape is dictated on where they live, which makes sense, right? Because these two different apertures or chambered are going to live in two different spots in the ocean. And some of them are benthic, which means they live in the ooze at the bottom of the seafloor. And then some of them are planktonic, which means you can find them somewhere, and they're kind of all throughout the water column.
And if you want to use a $50 geology word at your next party, benthic forams is high on the list.
I'll get to words here in a second, because so the benthic ones are in this ooze, right? Calcareous ooze, super gross. That's at the bottom of the ocean.
And this stuff is really, from to me as a rock mechanics person, fascinating, because you're looking at, it's not really rock.
No.
But it's not really water.
Mm-hmm.
It has a porosity of like 80%.
Yeah. It's like a non-Newtonian rock or something.
Yeah. It's like really fine suspended pieces of, it's almost like a rock colloid, but it's not.
Yes. That's a great way to describe it. So that stuff has lots of stuff, as all slime, in my opinion, has things living in it. So that's where these little benthic forams live, right? And I said that you can see them with the naked eye. They're pretty small, right? Like a millimeter. Some of them are bigger than that, but around that size. So there's a bunch of those that live there, and then a bunch of them that float in the water column. And so you can imagine, if you look at this picture that we can link to the different types, the ones that float in the water column have like these big cavernous chunks around them, so they look like they float. They're not flat. They look like they have a lot of air in them, ballast room, right? And
right,
that they can float around. And one of these is the grossest word I've ever heard in geology.
Oh, hit me.
And hopefully you've looked at the link that I have to this guy, Globigerina.
Yes.
I have remembered it since I took said pet 20-something years ago. It's even grosser because one of these guys lives in They're covered in Globergerina ooze. So gross.
It's one of those words, since we made the Ghostbusters reference earlier, like, the character from the original one, Slimer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You don't have to have seen Ghostbusters at all, and you can imagine exactly what Slimer looks like, and you're probably not far off.
Yeah, that is exactly right. He's not green. He's, like, white and clear.
Globigerina?
Yeah.
It's a bunch of blobs stuck together, and to add to the nightmare, it has spikes.
It's exactly what the word... It looks exactly what the word feels like in your mouth.
Is that your night science?
Yes. Yes, that's exactly right. Globigerina. Oh,
the Globigerina doesn't feel like anything, Shannon.
It sure does when it's in there eating little... Yo, we'll get to that part. This says ectoplasm, by the way, on it. Its habit is long, narrow spines that support a frothy, buoyant ectoplasm.
All right.
Gross. So these little guys are great. we use them for lots of things. So forams are a big deal, not just because they're gross and Globigerina is fun to say, but because they're used as climate proxies. Proxies are hard to come by, and planktonic and benthic forams are a great climate proxy.
And as you said, they're making these carbonate shells, which is going to come out of the water.
Mm-hmm.
And the water is directly coupled to the climate.
Mm-hmm.
And probably is going to lead to our favorite thing, isotope analysis.
We're both geophysicists, right? So is that all we can say? We can just say that and move on. Like, I understand that isotopic analysis has a level of physics to it, but so I mentioned earlier that they have tests that are made of carbonate, but carbonate comes in a bunch of different flavors, right? So CaCO3, that's carbonate. It's calcium and CO together. And one of the mysteries of geologic time is the fact that in today, if you go to the ocean, so today's oceans aren't making calcite, which is calcium and carbonate together. They're making aragonite. Okay.
Right, which has the same formula.
Right. So it's a...
But a different crystal habit.
Exactly. So it's a polymorph that's different. I just wrote this down. One of them's trigonal. I don't remember. Nor does it have any bearing on me. but the point is, this different polymorph of calcite... So some of these forams, if they lived in a time in Earth's history that had aragonite seas, are made of aragonite. But aragonite is not stable. It's metastable at Earth's surface, like diamonds, but on a shorter time scale. So over time, they will recrystallize into calcite, which is a problem. But then some of them are made of calcite because they're alive when there are calcite seas. Calcite comes in a couple different varieties, too. One that has low magnesium, which is like less than 4%, I think, magnesium in its crystalline structure, because calcium and magnesium are pretty close to the same size. So you can incorporate some magnesium in there. You could have high magnesium calcite, which is 8% or less. And then if you get too much magnesium, now you've made dolomite instead of calcite. So you can test these tests isotopically, and see what they're made of. And so that tells you something about the ocean chemistry at the time. But you can also test the oxygen isotopes within these tests. And that tells you a lot about climate.
Right.
Because, do you know the oxygen isotopes? No, because we're geophysicists. Exactly.
No, I'm... I mean, I can guess some numbers in the teens and probably get close.
You're correct. That is great. At least half 16 credit.
And 18, probably?
Perfect. Perfect.
Yeah, okay.
17's in there, too. We don't talk about 17. It's a tiny...
I know if it's lower teens, it's probably carbon.
That's right.
12, 13.
Exactly. You just... See? Chemistry. You did it. That was great. So they're taking in oxygen as part of their tests, and the ratio of O16 to O18 is a really good proxy for temperature, essentially. Because as you evaporate water, you preferentially evaporate the lighter isotopes because they're lighter, easier to evaporate, right? And then when you rain stuff out, you preferentially rain out the heavier isotopes because they're heavier, and that's how gravity works. And as you incorporate those oxygens into ice, it changes those ratios within the remaining ocean water. And so you can go in and test each individual little foram piece of their shell and see how those ratios have changed over that time that that foram lived. And therefore, you can say something not only about the climate in general, it was cool, it was warm. You can say something about the climate in both the in the entire water column, which is a big deal, right? Because that's how we run climate today, is we have this big thermohaline circulation. And we know that the temperature at the bottom of the ocean is different than at the top. But sometimes in geologic past, those temperature differences weren't much at all. How do you run climate when you don't circulate the ocean?
Yeah. I mean, that's yeah. what moves heat, right?
Correct. Yeah, it's a huge question. So one of the hottest times in geologic history is during the Cretaceous. And there were a lot of forams that lived during the Cretaceous. It was very warm. Obviously, the dinosaurs weren't driving around cars, but there were a lot of volcanoes.
We don't know, Shannon.
Okay, you're right. My kid does have a book that suggests otherwise, but but you look at the benthic forams and the planktonic forams and their oxygen isotope ratios, and they were fairly similar, which suggests that temperatures at the bottom of the ocean were super warm, and then temperatures within the ocean were warmer than the bottom, but weren't much different. And so there's a big question about how climate worked in the Cretaceous. This is really strange to me because I feel like that's not really very long ago, right? It's like, you know, 80 to 66 million years ago, something like that. And we just don't know. Right. We just don't
know. Which geologically is like saying the 60s.
Exactly. That's exactly like right.
Not that long ago.
And so we just don't know. But we do know that something weird was happening because we can use that oxygen in these very prolific forams and determine almost direct sea surface temperatures.
All right. So these are handy little climate black boxes.
Yeah. I also didn't know, and this was a video I linked in here too, and I watched a couple of times. So I've read a bunch of papers. We teach this in our Earth's Past Climate class, you know. So I've known that you can do this with carbonate. That's one of the good things about it, is that you can do all of this geochemistry on it. So modern forams, people are studying them now for climate. And they go out and they go like scuba diving and they catch them. And then they let them grow in the lab until they have these hard shells. And it's unclear whether they kill them or let them die naturally. And then they can do these isotopic experiments on their shells. I had no idea.
Interesting.
Yeah, I had no idea. And the coolest part of this video is they have a little foram that they've caught. These people must have great eyesight. Like, clearly, my eyesight is not this good. They go down and they're just scuba diving, hanging out, and they see one. And it's because their little ectoplasm shimmers with their little spikes. And so they catch them in a little vial and they take them back and let them live in the lab, but they have to feed them. And so the lab is also making these tiny, well, not tiny, they're tiny, but they're growing brine shrimp. And so they feed like the tiniest baby brine shrimp. They have to feed the forams. It was nuts.
Interesting.
It was so cool. So they sucked up these tiny little brine shrimp and then they plop it into I'm obviously making the hand motions as I'm talking about this. They plop it into the little vial that the globigerina or whatever were floating around in. And they would capture it in their little spines and then suck it in with the plasma. Yeah.
Interesting.
Isn't that weird? Like, you've seen these in Thin Section, but did you know they were these cold-blooded killers?
I did not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So weird. So they've been here. They're here now. There's lots of forums around now. But why? Another reason why they're so studied, so many forum papers, is that they've been around forever.
I mean, that is what you want if you want to get past climate markers.
Exactly. And so they've been around since the Cambrian. These things have been here almost as long as we've had oceans, right? And so that is one of the great things about them. Now, lots of things happen to rocks after they become rocks. And so the usefulness of forams obviously goes down as you get this far back in geologic time, right? Because lots of diagenesis has occurred on these rocks, and so they're probably not a good primary geochemical marker anymore. But there exists.
That won't scare a good geologist.
That's away. Exactly right. Because there
are some data are better than no data.
their simple existence, just saying, look, I found this one type of forum, is use for the word that you said earlier in the show, biomarker. So these guys have come into existence, gone extinct. We have detailed records about which ones lived when. And as I constantly say to my class, in geology, it's very expensive to get an actual age, right? But it's pretty inexpensive to get a relative age. So
right.
Numbers are expensive, but time spans are relatively cheap. And forams, well, some forams, are a really good way to do this sort of cheap dating of rocks because they were only alive for a certain amount of time.
Okay, yeah, I can see that.
Mm-hmm. And so you also mentioned at the beginning a word, fusilinid.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why do you remember that one?
We saw a lot of them.
Yeah, we sure did.
They've been around forever.
Correct. And they're shaped.
Well, okay. We're geologists. They've been around since the Devonian.
Exactly. So they're shaped like footballs. And they're one of those ones that's easy to see. Some of these ones that have these weird habits, like their tests are weird habits, it's harder to tell that it's a foram. You're like, yeah, that's probably a foram. But fusilinids are chambered. They're like you've drawn a chambered circle and you squish it down into a football shape. So they're very easy to spot. Right. So that's why we talk about fusilinids. So that's what they look like. And as I said, a lot of our rocks in our sedimentology collection are like from the Paleozoic. These little football-shaped fusilinids, in 3D, they look like footballs too. It's not just their cross section. really messed me up when I was in undergrad, not in SedPed, but in paleo. And my paleo TA was just the best. I hope he listens. such a prankster. He had a jar of wheat seeds. And they looked exactly like forams.
Interesting.
Yep. And so you're used to seeing them in cross-section, yeah. But when you see them in a rock, they're these 3D little things. In fact, it looks just like a wheat seed. And so that was one of our quiz questions once. And he thought it was so hilarious that we did not identify these wheat seeds correctly. We thought they were forams from the Devonian. Yep. gets me every time. I still think about it. Thanks, Galen Miller. That was real funny.
But all I mean, that's a good reminder to not go into something with some preconceived notions of what you're going to see, right?
That is exactly right. Fine, it taught us a lesson, yada yada. So these little wheat seeds, the fusulinids, the early ones were all benthic, and then the planktonic ones didn't come around until the mid-Jurassic. I don't know why. I don't know why it took so long for them to figure out how to make these weird shapes instead of chambers and float all around. But there were lots of planktonic forms during that warm area of the Cretaceous. As we came into the Cenozoic, stuff started getting really cold, and so there was a massive planktonic die-off. And in fact, I don't know if that's true, but many forams have gone extinct since the Miocene, because that was one of the last times the Earth was pretty warm, especially it's like one of the warmest periods in the Cenozoic. And so they've been dying. But there's actually a lot of work on these modern ones about how they're moving poleward, right? As everything gets too hot at the equator, they're shifting. And so not only are these important for just climate numbers in general, is the climate warm or cold? Is the ocean bottom, is the ocean column warm or cold? Is there ice on land due to the oxygen fractionation? But also, they're pretty interesting latitudinally. So looking at how they change over time latitudinally gives us a lot of information about like rate of change of climate, which is kind of a hard number to get to.
Yeah, I could see that. Mm-hmm. It sounds like a lot of sampling's required though.
Oh, so much sampling. That is exactly right. But some of the sampling is just going scuba diving, so that's awesome science.
That would be fun, but then there would also be some much less desirable sampling trips.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. The fusulinids that I've seen that most look like wheat seeds are like in the middle of Texas, so that's not as fun as scuba diving because we were there in, you know, July, and that was not great.
Right.
Yeah, like, those are nice. Can we get back in the car now? but these little guys are also good for... That was a very night science thing to say, right? These little guys. They're also good for talking about the chemistry, not necessarily the carbonate chemistry, but like the salinity of water, because there are freshwater forams and saltwater forams. And that's something maybe you don't always know immediately from the sedimentary rocks you're looking at. But once you can identify the little foram, you can say something about kind of a specific environment that they're in.
Yeah. So, you know, we normally think of plankton, quote unquote, as a saltwater ocean thing. But yeah, if you can have fresh water, that makes doing things like river analysis suddenly possible.
Exactly. This is quite the big deal in part of the research that I am involved with. And this isn't my part of the research. So I'm there as a paleomagnetist, and what we're looking at are deposits from the Colorado River. So as the Colorado River carved the Grand Canyon and took a turn, there's a lot of question about the timing of how long it took to get down eventually into the Salton Sea. And so looking at the deposits of the river is the way to do it, right? And so you can look at, get some actual dates, and then fill in those gaps with magnetostratigraphy. But as you get further south, there's a lot of question about the tectonic nature of what's happened down there. So when the Colorado River first flowed all the way to the ocean, this was pre-San Andreas Fault. So the San Andreas Fault has displaced a lot of those deposits in its strike-slip fashion. And so there's questions about what that habitat was. Was it an estuary where you have big river hitting the ocean? And so you've got a zone of not exactly fresh water, not exactly salty water. Or were the tectonics such that it was all marine or all river? And the forams can help answer that, because there are forams that live in very specific saline concentrations. So you couldn't take a foram from the middle of an estuary and stick it in a river. It would, well, what would it do? If it's used to being salty and then you suddenly put it in fresh water, it would explode? Not explode.
I would think it would explode.
Right?
Yeah.
So there's questions about this. And of course, by the law of, I don't know, serendipity, some of these places exist where there have been found only a few specific forams that say, oh, look, these are salty water forams. So this must have been an estuary, not just a river hitting the ocean and there's no estuary situation. And then the controversy occurs by saying, okay, well, this is only like 4 million years ago. It's not very long ago at all. We have birds, right? We have birds that like to walk around near the ocean. As these birds are walking around, they pick up mud on their legs. Forams live in mud. So maybe these couple of forams you found were carried on the mud on the legs of a bird that landed in a lake, freshwater lake.
Was it a swallow?
Definitely a Southern Californian swallow. Not an African one.
Of course not.
Oh, so isn't that great? I stay out of it. I'm like, I'm doing the paleo mag part, but isn't that interesting?
That is interesting.
Because that could happen. What are the chances of catching that in the rock record?
I would say preposterously slim, but then I also have a rock sample that has fossilized raindrops. So
not zero.
So you're saying there's a chance.
Exactly. So even though I teach about these things, they still intrude themselves into my research. It probably wasn't a globigerina, though.
Probably not, but you know, one exciting thing, you know, we kind of already mentioned it about this, though, is that you have to go on a lot of sampling trips.
So many sampling trips to so many different locations.
So many ways to die. And that brings us to today's fun paper. No Time to Die, an in-depth analysis of James Bond's exposure to infectious agents by Graumans et al.
This oh, you could have also used that poor little saline foram dying in a freshwater lake as well. There's a lot of good segues here, because this is my new favorite paper. It's got my new favorite figure in a scientific paper. This is in an Elsevier journal, and it's right. The funniest paper maybe I've ever read.
It's in Travel Medicine and Infectious Disease, which sounds like a journal that's worth subscribing to.
100%. So this is from 2021. Where did you find this?
You know, browsing the internet. Looking for fun papers.
As one does. And also, this is from 2021. I can't believe we hadn't done this.
I can't believe we haven't done it or it hadn't been sent in by anybody, but I cannot find anything, and as far as I know, was able to find it.
I couldn't either, because I was like, for sure we've done, before I actually read the paper, and I just saw James Bond, because I feel like we've done James Bond stuff before. Anyway, this is in an Elsevier paper, and as so many of these fun papers are, I mean, this might start off with like the best intro ever to a paper, right?
I mean, I'll give you the honors.
Life as an infectious disease researcher is indisputably exciting. Agreed. Daily encounters with life-threatening microorganisms, academic competitors, hostile reviewing committees, and extensive international travel can make for a thrilling career. International espionage is possibly the only profession that overshadows our branch of academia in these respects. I mean, to have, like, to write this and send it in, like, this is a scientific paper. I love it so much.
While researchers tend to be well-informed of risks they could encounter when traveling, the same cannot be said for some secret agents. James Bond is an exemplar of reckless disregard for occupational health.
Oh my gosh, this was so great. So they have viewed 3,113 minutes of James Bond films, as they say, during evening hours that were not spent on more pressing societal issues or forms of relaxation that are more acceptable in academic circles.
I mean, 3,600 minutes is 60 hours, so this is a time commitment.
Oh, that's right. And to analyze it, gosh, this is just the best night science thing ever. They begin, well, the whole paper lists all these different infectious disease situations that have happened to James Bond. And obviously, when you think about James Bond, you think about how promiscuous he is. And that's the first one they talk about.
And yeah, they count the number of liaisons and uh-huh. say that there's no correlation between that and the rating of the movie. So this seems like not necessary amorous audacity.
Exact words right there. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. I wouldn't have even thought to take the IMDb rating and correlate it to this. Right. I love that they also look at the clocks on the walls and figure out that there's no time for James Bond and his partner to discuss any previous encounters they've had and therefore talk about their risks for infectious disease. And in fact, most of James Bond's partners die. There's a high mortality rate.
Although STIs played no obvious role in any of their deaths.
Oh, amazing. This one I never would have thought of, but I guess as an infectious food person, you would think about it a lot, is that obviously Montezuma's Revenge is a huge thing that happens to travelers. And so you should wash your hands. And it said there's only two instances of him washing his hands. Period.
Mm-hmm. I feel like this is a really fun analysis that we should do on different franchises now.
100%, right? This is so good. Like,
how many times in TNG does somebody wash their hands?
Exactly. I bet it's way more than two. The best part right here in this discussion is where they talk about, you know, one of the old Bond villains who had this Persian cat. And so they say he clearly has toxoplasmosis because of how many times he's interacted with this cat. Amazing. It says that toxoplasmosis would explain Bond's foolhardy courage in the face of life-threatening danger.
And I did not know this, but said that toxoplasmosis makes mice not afraid of cats in an effort to spread itself.
Isn't that nuts? Toxoplasmosis is the scariest stuff ever. I'm sure I have it. I read a lot about it because when you're pregnant, you're not supposed to change the litter box, which is like the best part of being pregnant. Because I've always had cats. And I'm like, I'm sure I already have this because it's such a literal mind-altering infection. It has, there's all these studies about toxoplasmosis and like introversion and psychoticism and all this. Yeah. Yeah.
This explains so, just so much.
One more reason for you to not have a cat. I already know you would never have one, but there you go.
No.
Yeah. Really weird.
Mm-hmm. I will take my dumb dogs.
Yep. Their bacteria aren't trying to control you like cats' bacteria is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's really interesting. I mean, it goes through, how many do they wind up? Yeah, there's six different.
Yeah, there's six different sections. Mm-hmm. A lot of them plays on Bond titles, like The Fly Who Loved Me, Arthropod-Borne Diseases.
Arthropod-Borne Diseases.
Or Tomorrow in the Skies.
Dr. Nope. Yeah, neglected tropical diseases. Yeah, that one seems like would definitely have happened to him. Yeah, the Tomorrow in the Skies is really funny. The problem of poor travel preparation, and they blame it on MI6.
Now, I'm most interested in section 4, The Fly Who Loved Me, where they're talking about mosquitoes.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that Bond obviously has had close shaves with industrial lasers, thanks to Goldfinger.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But then there's a citation that I want to look up. Because it says that there has been work done on using lasers to combat mosquitoes. So I want to find this laser bug light.
And buy it.
And see if it's commercially available.
And if not,
because we could have a light show here in Arkansas.
Oh, man, that's amazing. Oh, gosh, this is so good. Again, my new favorite academic paper figure. Right? The iconic picture of James Bond looking down the, you know, cylindrical barrel of a gun. And yet it's a word cloud of these different, like, these different infectious diseases that he has come into contact with.
And they're color-coded? Why are they air and droplet-borne, vector-borne,
mm-hmm.
health and safety, so on? And, yeah, some of the big ones are kind of eating unwashed fruits. They count the number of times that happens.
Yes, I mean, they did everything. There's one where he handles raw chicken, where he's feeding it to an alligator so he doesn't get killed by the alligator. I mean, like, I don't know if I would have even caught that while watching it, right? There had to be a lot of, like, pausing to write this stuff down. Surely.
Yes.
Dehydration caused by alcohol consumption. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. They do point out, let's see, how many times was it that he was seen drinking?
Yeah.
On only 3 occasions was Bond observed drinking non-alcoholic drinks. Orange juice, coffee, and salt water. None of which are particularly helpful in maintaining fluid balance.
Amazing. Eating uncooked oysters. Tiger is a random one. Scorpion. This one, I love this one. In the air and droplet-borne diseases, wearing another person's face mask.
Oh, they have a whole paragraph on that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I
looked at the figure first, and that one, I don't know why that one jumped out, and I was like, oh, which one is this under?
Yeah, wearing a Dia de los Muertos mask with an unknown particle filtering capacity.
Oh, man, that was in one of the new ones. This is really interesting. The exposure to animals. So this is also, like you said, color-coded, not jet color-coded. And the exposure to animals one is red. And so there are these random animals throughout this word cloud. Tiger, scorpion, shark. So many sharks.
Yeah. And they talk about snakes and how, like, one of the snakes that's trying to kill him that he blows up is actually just a common household pet.
Oh.
It's not venomous or anything.
See, and then domestic cat is down there. Oh my gosh, this was so good. It was so well written. I love how they throw MI6 under the bus for, like, poor travel preparation and all this, but also the funding is really good too. The funding accreditation here.
There was no specific funding for this project. Given the futility of its academic value, this is deemed entirely appropriate by all authors.
It's so good.
Like in the crediting.
Yes.
All listed authors meet authorship criteria, agree that there is no intellectual content whatsoever, and endorse the final version of the manuscript.
It's so amazing. And then the references are like every Bond film, which is also awesome.
I just can't believe, like you said, that this was an Elsevier publication.
I know. I thought for sure this was going to be a BMJ thing. No. I love it. It makes me hate Elsevier a little less, right? This is great. This is great science.
Yeah.
It's actually really observationally impressive, though, for real, in terms of the science. It's very impressive.
I mean, when Twister comes out, we can do this with meteorology, right?
Oh, I don't even know if I can watch it. We'll see.
I think we have to.
We do have to. Fine. All right.
Well, if you've got your own chart of air and droplet-borne virus or vector-borne ways for your favorite movie villain or hero, we'd love to see those. Shannon, how can they get a hold of us?
Don't panic, geocast@gmail.com. You can tweet your figures as everyone else does, right? We're on X at Don't Panic Geo, at Shannon Doolin, and at @Geo_Lehman. And as always, thank you to our Patreon supporters. If you would like to support us, you may do so. Patreon.com/Don't Panic Geo.
And until next week, remember, don't panic.
It's not an exact science.
Any opinions, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed are solely ours and do not necessarily reflect the views of our employers or funding agencies.